Jihadis in Syria embrace an American suicide bomber. Today, Thursday, May 29th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The war in Syria may have taken a new turn after a U.S. citizen reportedly carried out a suicide attack. Extremists in Syria are treating it as a propaganda coup.
They're vocally claiming that they have an American, the first American. They keep repeating that.
Also today, the pesky question of how voter ID laws affect immigrants.
For me, the issue is, are we making it more difficult for some people to vote, or are we making it safer?
Plus, working hard to explain what hospice care is to people from cultures where the concept is unfamiliar.
It's not how you want to die. It's how you want to live until the end.
And feeling nostalgic for India's iconic automobile, the Ambassador. Those stories after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Syria is more than 5,000 miles from the east coast of the U.S., and while the war there may seem distant to many of us, it's not that way for all Americans. Take one young man, a U.S. citizen, who went by the alias Abu Huraya al-Amriki. For him, the war to topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad was apparently important enough to lay his life on the line. He allegedly traveled to Syria to fight with an al-Qaeda-backed group called the Nusra Front, and on Sunday, this American reportedly carried out a suicide bombing in Syria. That's according to U.S. officials who will not speak on the record about the case. Aaron Baker, Time Magazine's Middle East bureau chief, is following the story.
What we're seeing from the Nusra Front and various other jihadi groups in Syria, they are tweeting that an American, the first American suicide bomber, was effective in a suicide attack on Sunday in Idlib. What we don't know is if he was American-born, naturalized, where he came from. He's a real mystery.
And no sense of how he was radicalized?
No, but, you know, what's happening now? There's an estimated 70 or so Americans fighting in Syria right now and a couple hundred Europeans, Brits. What's happening is a lot of them go over because they feel that they need to help. They're probably Muslim to begin with. They feel like they want to do something to help their brethren. And once they're there, they're easily sucked into some of the more extremist radical groups because those groups are the best organized and more open to foreigners. And that's where the radicalization process happens, is once they're already in Syria.
All of these foreign fighters, they're all fighting against Bashar al-Assad?
I actually was just in Syria and met in the city of Homs an American straight from my hometown in California who was fighting for Assad. So, yes, there are some exceptions, but I think they're very rare.
Wow. So somebody from your hometown.
Fighting for Assad, yes. It was a very surreal accent to be hearing as I walked down a completely bombed out city. It was very bizarre.
As for this suicide bombing on Sunday, apparently there is a video online recording the attack.
A couple of clips spliced together, so we can't be certain that it's accurate. Again, this stuff is very hard to verify. But what you're seeing is a couple of men loading shells into a large truck. And then the next scene cuts to the truck driving off. So it's barreling down a highway. And then the next shot you see is from a distance, a fortress-type city and in the distance, and then all of a sudden a blinding flash of light and a pillar of smoke and people going Allah Akbar, praise to God, and celebration.
What has been kind of general reaction from other jihadists? Would they feel triumphant that they've essentially flipped an American?
Absolutely. You're seeing this sense of triumph in social media. They're saying that he was accepted by God as a martyr. And they're very vocally claiming that they have an American, the first American. They keep repeating that. And it's quite a coup for them.
I mean, the fact that this was an American suicide bomber in Syria raises all sorts of kind of frightening scenarios, frankly.
Well, the big fear now is that you'll have some people going with the intention of perhaps blowing themselves up in Syria to further the cause, but who may have been talked into changing their focus and returning to America to attack U.S. sites.
You know, we heard about White House plans for a counterterrorism force, a small fleet-footed force, and some of that help is going to go to Syria. How's this going to complicate those plans, if the U.S. is trying to both arm the rebels, and some of those rebels might be Americans who want to freelance their own kind of violence.
It does create quite a conundrum of whether or not the rebels should be armed, and if so, how.
Erin Baker, Middle East Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Amid all the fighting and suicide bombing, Syrians are getting ready to vote. Next week, the Assad government is planning to hold a presidential election in the middle of a civil war. Western governments say the vote is a sham, and President Assad is widely expected to claim re-election. Syrian expats are being allowed to vote. Already, they've been casting their absentee ballots at Syrian embassies around the globe. In Lebanon, an unexpectedly large turnout forced polls to stay open until the wee hours this morning, and voting there was extended for another day. Susanna George reports on what sounds like a chaotic evening.
Traffic along the highway leading to the embassy was at a standstill for much of the day Wednesday, clogged with voters traveling by taxi, on foot, and by the busload to cast their ballots for Syria's presidential elections. By evening, long after the polls were originally supposed to close, the road was still congested. A handful of minibuses packed with Assad supporters lurched in the stop-and-go traffic. Past a series of checkpoints and roadblocks, a steady stream of people made their way single file into the heavily guarded embassy. And that's where order breaks down. Ballot distribution and collection is haphazard. Crowds of men holding up their ID cards jostle up against a metal barricade. Overwhelmed embassy personnel yell back instructions. One family is standing off to the side, bewildered. I ask them if they're waiting to vote.
Too much people, so we don't know if we can do it today or no.
Samir, his whole family asked to only use their first names, is originally from the ancient Syrian Christian town of Malula. He fled to Beirut nearly 2 years ago. He already has his family's ballots, but doesn't know where to cast them. By his side, his aunt Antoinette explains that a stable Syria with Assad as president is better than any alternative.
We prefer to go back to Syria with Assad the president than to live outside our country. We used to have very nice life, so why we have to do the opposite thing?
While there are two other candidates on the ballots being handed out, none of the voters here mention them. Samir says his vote is both for Assad and against the opposition.
Both, because there is the other side, they are fighting us. They are supporting the terrorists. So this is why we are supporting President Assad and we are against the other side.
The sun's gone down, and all around us, people are filling out ballots. Those who can't find space under lit tents are using flashlights and cell phones. Lacking any formal direction, people are passing along instructions by word of mouth.
Number two, Ibrahim.
Here, one man tells another what information to write on the back of the ballot. Your name, the names of your mother, father, and grandfather, and your national ID number. Election officials say this data will prevent fraud, even if it doesn't allow voters any political privacy. By 10 at night, the mob clamoring to vote is still growing. Antoinette, the woman from Malula, is still standing off to the side. She jokes that if she isn't able to vote for Assad here tonight, she'll sleep at the embassy until the polls open in the morning.
We love him. Why not?
For the world, I'm Susanna George in Beirut.
Elections vary greatly in different countries, even when the vote is not being held in a war zone. But it's not unusual for voters in other countries to have to show some form of ID to cast their ballots. Here in the U.S., we're less used to that, but more and more Americans are being required to show a photo ID to vote. Indiana was among the first states to pass a voter ID law back in 2005. The World's Jason Margolis went there to see how the law has impacted immigrants.
If you ask attorney Tom Wheeler, who does work with the Republican Party, whether there was voter fraud in Indiana in 2003, he'll say this.
The fraud was so bad that the Supreme Court couldn't even figure out who won the race.
That's the Indiana Supreme Court. But ask Bill Groth, a lawyer who represents Democratic Party interests, and you'll hear this.
The state of Indiana later stipulated that there was not a single recorded prosecution for imposter voting fraud in the history of the state.
So which man is lying? Neither. The courts found extensive voter fraud in the Democratic mayoral primary in East Chicago, Indiana, but with absentee ballots, rumors of in-person fraud were rampant as well. The Republican-controlled state legislature used the situation to help pass Indiana's voter ID requirement for in-person voting. The law got challenged, but the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately upheld it, ruling that voter fraud did pose a risk in the Hoosier state. Bill Grouth argued the real risk was disenfranchising voters. His legal team hired a statistician who estimated between 8 and 23% of registered voters in greater Indianapolis lacked proper IDs.
But the district court judge didn't agree with his methodology and basically disregarded his entire conclusion.
Tom Wheeler also disregards the Democrats' conclusions.
If photo ID is designed to suppress minority turnout, Democratic turnout, it didn't work very well in Indiana. It had actually the opposite effect.
After the law was passed, more voters showed up. The state also backed a Democrat for president, Barack Obama, for the first time since 1964. But was the increased turnout connected to the state's ID requirement? Did Indiana voters have a restored trust in elections? Or were they excited about Obama? And were people without IDs turned away from the polls, or did the law just discourage them from even showing up at all? It's hard to say. There's little data out there, just anecdotal evidence. I visited the Immigrant Welcome Center in Indianapolis to gather some more anecdotal perspectives.
My name is Mary Von Kurzabi, and I am originally from France.
Marjorie Duarte Sheffield, I'm from Venezuela.
My name is Felipe Martinez. I was born in Monterrey, Mexico, and became a U.S. citizen in 2007.
I asked them how likely immigrants are to get state-issued IDs.
It was very easy for me to apply for a driver's license and get my ID.
I came in 2000. It was July, and I think in August, I already have my ID.
For me as an immigrant, the hoops I've had to jump through have required the documentation. So for me at this point, getting an ID is no problem. The problem comes for the people that were born citizens of the United States that have difficulty having access to their to the birth certificates because maybe they were poor or never registered, you know, those kinds of things that you talk about a different kind of population altogether.
Martinez adds that many low-income minorities rely on public transportation and never get a driver's license. Marjorie Duarte Sheffield said it's not asking so much to get the state-issued ID, which is free. She's also used to the requirement. Most of Latin America requires an ID to vote.
The country where I come from, we have to have ID to vote. So I believe that somebody could say, hey, I'm Marjorie Duarte and I want to vote. And if they don't show an ID, could do it.
I think having an ID is not a bad idea. So I don't oppose that on principle. What I suggest, though, is that in the state of Indiana, it ought to be possible for somebody without an ID to vote with a sworn statement that they are who they say they are. For me, the issue is, are we making it more difficult for some people to vote, or are we making it safer?
Martinez takes the Democrat position. This is politics. A solution in search of a problem. Perhaps, but again, are people without IDs being disenfranchised en masse in Indiana? The voter ID requirement certainly adds an additional barrier to voting, but there's no evidence to suggest scores of people in Indiana are being turned away at the polls. For newly naturalized Americans, they're also a pretty self-motivated group. Their new commitment doesn't end with an oath.
When you vote, it just adds another layer. When you vote for a first time, you feel that you really belong, that you're part of a country.
And if that means getting a state-issued ID, they'll do it. So while Indiana's new photo ID laws may not equate to a modern-day poll tax, critics remain deeply concerned by the growing trend of similar laws, especially in states with histories of discriminatory practices at the polls. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis. Indianapolis.
Later on The World, we've got the story of the ambassador with four wheels from India, whose credentials are solid, but he's retiring anyway, on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Think back to the last selfie you took, whatever you were showing off, a new haircut maybe, or a beautiful vista in the background. I bet that selfie didn't include bags full of garbage in the frame. I hope not, anyway. Unless you're in Tunisia, it probably doesn't make sense. It's actually the trend in the North African country right now for people to take a selfie in front of any place filled with trash and then post it to Facebook or Twitter. Our BBC colleague Sehem Hassani can hopefully shed some light on this. Sehem, what is the point?
Well, these selfie pubela, we call them in Tunisian, you know, the selfie garbage, it's an initiative who began 2 months ago on Facebook. These are citizens who decided to take selfies with garbage. They want to denounce pollution and the increase of garbage all over Tunisia.
And how did the whole thing begin?
Well, for people who live here, you can notice that there is garbage almost everywhere in all neighborhoods, from the bourgeoisie to popular places. We have this smell, this disgusting landscape of garbage. There is also a sanitary problem. Mosquitoes, asthma, diseases related to pollution are increasing in the country, especially at summertime. And the government was till now doing nothing.
You live in Tunis, right?
I live in Tunis capital, yeah.
What's the situation with garbage in your own neighborhood?
In my neighborhood, at 7 a.m. every day, I can see garbage collectors taking rubbish in their own hands, which is very dangerous. The problem is there is a lack of equipment. They also suffer from the situation. When it's winding, the wind is putting the garbage in houses, in gardens. For many also tourists that I talked with, they have seen that Tunisia is changing in a bad way.
There's a Facebook page devoted to these pictures, and it has now nearly 13,000 likes. A lot of Tunisians obviously are annoyed by garbage. What is the government actually doing about it, though?
Well, since the fall of dictatorship, Tunisian government was not taking as a priority the problem of garbage in Tunisia. And he recently, he's proposing new strategies to face pollution. And he's proposing now to do campaign to protect environment.
When you say he, you're talking about Prime Minister Jomah.
Prime Minister Mahdi Jomah, yeah. He wants to put more money in the cities who are facing pollution. But the real problem is also about civil society and schools who have to educate people to throw papers when they find a garbage bin and to stop throwing their garbage in the streets.
Yeah, we don't realize how important the garbage collectors are until there are piles of garbage everywhere. Our colleague at the BBC, Sehem Hassani, in Tunis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can see some of those trash selfies. We've got them at PRI.org. Also from the Missing Your Water When the Well Runs Dry department, vision. We take it for granted, but if you've ever had to close your eyes for a really long time, you know how disconcerting it can be. Which takes us to a small, remote town in Peru called Paran. About 1 in 6 people there has a degenerative form of blindness. But because the town was so isolated, almost no one knew about it until a few years ago. Reporter Annie Murphy in Paran tells the story.
Paran's in the foothills of the Andes, and it sits on several really steep, rocky hillsides. It's home to only about 300 people. So everybody here knew about the men who go blind in their 50s, and that a lot of young men and boys have trouble seeing too, especially at night. Jessica Palomares has a 10-year-old son named Lucho.
With my son, I started to realize that something was going on because he started to walk all wrong. He'd want to wander around, but he tripped everywhere, and he ran into things.
But no one knew why this was happening. Remember, the town was really isolated, and most people here had never seen a doctor. Then, about 2 years ago, doctors started to arrive in Paran. They were sent by a mining company looking to do exploration in the area as kind of an outreach effort. Locals hoped the doctors would give them glasses or medicine to fix their vision problems. Instead, the doctors told them it was a genetic condition called retinitis pigmentosa. Bit by bit, it knocks out the cells in the retina, like pixels going out in a computer screen. And it's caused by a mutation on the X chromosome. So while women can carry the disease, it's usually the men who go blind. Ricardo Fujita was one of the doctors who visited Paran. He says there's no cure for the disease, but that it's still important for locals to know about it.
Anyways, they will have the problem, something that nobody right now can stop. So I think that it's better to prepare them. This is a poor people. We can look for ways to help them.
Fujita says he and other doctors hope to get funding to return, to keep doing research. But many people in Paran say they feel like the doctors gave them this life-changing information and then vanished. Some even say it made things worse. Asteria Palomares is Jessica's mother. She says other villages now think of Paran as a town full of blind people. It's sad, it's pathetic, she says. The town had gotten known for growing peaches, but now everyone knows the town because of these children who are going blind. According to Asteria, some people in the surrounding area make fun of Paran, and they say young people from Paran shouldn't marry anyone outside Paran, and that if they do leave, they should go far away, that no one wants people from Paran settling in their town. Before the doctors came, Asteria's other daughter, Abigail, had married a guy who wasn't from Paran. And when the doctors announced the blindness was something that was inherited, her husband's family had a lot to say about it.
It started during a conversation when we were all having lunch with his siblings. His brother said to him, "Your child is going to be blind." And he said, "If this child is blind, I'll go have kids with another woman."
At first, she thought he was joking, but it wasn't just that one time. He started to talk about it all the time, sometimes when they were with other people. Sometimes, when it was just the two of them.
He said it like this: "If my child is blind, then why keep going? It'll be better if I leave you to have a child with another woman, so that child can take care of my blind son. Because how will my son get around if he can't see?"
Abigail still hopes it was a joke, but she says she feels like her husband's family blames her, like she's somehow at fault. Now, she figures all she can do is to stay quiet and hope for the best. She often thinks about what it was like before the doctors and journalists came around asking questions, when Paran was just an isolated town that grew peaches.
They made it known that there's just a bunch of blind people here. But now that there haven't been any doctors or journalists around for a while, time passes, things get forgotten. And since they've stopped coming, we just sort of forget too.
A few weeks after we last saw her, Abigail gave birth to a little girl, which means she may be a carrier, but she won't develop the disease. For The World, I'm Annie Murphy, Paran, Peru.
Annie's story was produced in collaboration with Marco Aviles and Radio Ambulante. News headlines are coming your way in about a minute. You're hearing The World because you're tuned to The World from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, how a Nashville man's career took off after he sang a song on Swedish TV.
First time I saw that when he performed it on the TV show, and it was a complete knockout. And I was not the only one feeling that. He's got something very, very special.
Plus, saying goodbye to India's ambassador cars.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. When you're under pressure, blame Washington. That's long been the playbook for the government of Venezuela, first under the late Hugo Chavez and now under his successor, Nicolas Maduro. Well, Maduro has been under intense pressure lately, and once again, those in power in Caracas are blaming the U.S., specifically the American ambassador in neighboring Colombia. The mayor of the Venezuelan capital, Jorge Rodriguez, says he has proof that the U.S. diplomat is plotting with the opposition to stage a coup against Maduro. Arturo Wallace, with our friends at BBC Mundo, is in Caracas, and he's covering the story in detail.
The mayor of Caracas, Mr. Rodriguez, quoted a series of emails between several leading members of the Venezuelan opposition, chiefly among them Maria Corina Machado, a former member of parliament, in which they mentioned the support and even instructions from Kevin Whitaker, the current ambassador to Bogota and former man in charge of Andean affairs at the State Department. It's not clear whether they're referring to this alleged plot to kill President Maduro or just to a general strategy of trying to increase the pressure on President Maduro through street protests to try to force his resignation to destabilize the Bolivarian Revolution, as they call it here in Venezuela.
Right. So it's this opposition politician, Maria Corina Machado, allegedly telling in this email a former presidential candidate named Diego Arria to, quote, step up efforts and obtain financial help to, quote, annihilate Maduro. So the government is interpreting that as an assassination plot?
Yeah, that's the government's interpretation. And they said that beyond the emails, they also have other evidence that they will disclose in due time and that there is a criminal investigation. Maria Corina Machado, of course, she has denied the accusations. She said that she called it a fabrication. She said that anybody familiar with her style in writing would realize that that wasn't her.
That was not her.
She said that the current Venezuelan government is desperate because of the protests that have been affecting Venezuela for the last 3 months. And the American government has already denied any sort of involvement. They also said the accusations were baseless and false.
There is a pattern here, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a pattern. This is not the first time President Maduro or people close to him actually denounce assassination attempts or plans to try to assassinate him. He has even implicated former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe. But so far, none of these alleged plots have resulted in any sort of formal accusation against the alleged plotters.
Does this time feel different, though, Arturo, or is it kind of same wine, different bottles?
Well, right now it feels like the same. You know, the opposition is laughing at the accusation, saying that it's just proof that the government is desperate and trying to intimidate the opposition and trying actually to distract people from the real problems. It might change if indeed there is a criminal investigation and charges are formally presented against Maria Corina Machado and she's actually arrested because of this. But so far, it doesn't seem it would go that way, although yesterday the mayor of Caracas said that more evidence would be made public in the next few days.
Arturo, do you remember the last time things were okay between the United States and Venezuela?
Honestly, I don't. I probably have to go way back before President Chavez was first elected, but it's been a while since the tensions have been piling up. Certainly for the current Venezuelan government, it's quite an useful scapegoat in a way, because they tend to blame United States interference and, you know, this sort of attempts, or what they claim are attempts from the Venezuela's opposition to try to topple a democratically elected government to justify many of the problems that the Venezuelans face.
Both countries seem to enjoy this abusive relationship. BBC Mundo's Arturo Wallace is in Caracas. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Picture now a really old Volvo with its softer, rounder edges, you know, before the company went all boxy. Those soft curves give you an idea of what an ambassador looks like. I'm talking about the first car ever manufactured in India. It became the iconic automobile in the country, changing very little in over six decades on the road. Last week, the ambassador reached the end of the road. The manufacturer, Hindustan Motors, halted production. The Ambi, as fans call it, was long the vehicle of choice for Indian politicians who rode white ones, and also taxi drivers who continued to drive bright yellow ones. It's also the car of choice for Siddharth Vardarajan, former editor of the Hindu newspaper in Delhi. He owns three.
The oldest model I have is from 1952. Back in the day, it used to be called Hindustan 14. And then I have another model from 1954 when they introduced a variant called the Landmaster. And the newest ambassador I have is from 2006. So three ambassadors representing three different designs, three different eras, if you will, but one great tradition.
You know, I've been trying to rack my brain to come up with a U.S. analogy for the ambassador, and I can't really come up with them. It's so seemingly embedded into Indian culture and history at this point. I mean, what does it really represent for India, this car?
Well, you know, it harks back to the early days of Indian independence, years of great hope, optimism, years of great endeavor of where the country has to head. So it's very tied up with, I suppose, a certain vision of the country, with all its faults, incidentally. I think, you know, the ambassador at the end of the day was not a great automotive product by any means. Its technology was ancient. It wasn't very efficient in fuel or pollution terms. So in a way, it represented the hopes and aspirations and visions of a country, warts and all.
So what does it mean then that it's no longer going to be made? I mean, there's something kind of sad about that to me.
I think it's tragic. I think the ambassador, you know, had become something of a niche product over the last 10 or 15 years when a whole rash of new cars entered India following some kind of a liberalization policy. So the car buying middle class or upper middle class preferred to go for Japanese or European models and abandoned the ambassador. So it became essentially the preserve of the government. So, you know, most government fleets consisted of ambassador cars. And I suppose the bureaucrat and the politician at some stage also began to tire of this car. And I think there came a time finally when Hindustan Motors realized that it simply was not worth its while to keep the whole factory going. I think it's a sad day. I'm still hoping somewhere down the line that the company will change its mind or come up with a radical plan to restore this car to the once iconic position that it had in the public imagination.
What's it feel like to drive the ambassador around a big Indian city like Delhi? I mean, is it a smooth ride, or you feel kind of all the potholes?
You know, it takes some getting used to because the steering can be quite heavy. And it's larger, and the wheelbase is slightly higher than for other motor cars. But I think I find it a great drive. I wouldn't drive anything else. And whenever I drive more modern cars, I feel very awkward, both within the city and for drives in the countryside where the roads can be quite uneven. The ambassador, I think, handles things very well. So it's sort of quintessential. I think it's a car for the Indian ethos, for the Indian roads, for the Indian psyche. And as these cars get rarer and rarer, in fact, when I drive my 1952 or 54 models, a lot of people stop and ask, God, gosh, how old is that car? Mm. And of course, the inevitable Indian question that, you know, what kind of mileage do you get? Indians are obsessed with fuel economy, and people always want to know, well, you know, how many kilometers do you get for every liter of petrol?
Right. I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are.
The answer is not good, by the way.
Yeah, what is the answer?
It's about 8. It's rubbish. It's really not good. But you know, if you're passionate about this motor car, then you just lump it.
I suppose you'll be hanging on to your 3 ambassadors.
For as long as they run and as long as I can get parts and even beyond.
Siddharth Vardarajan, former editor-in-chief of the Hindu newspaper. Thanks so much. Enjoy your ride.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Here's a question we didn't get to ask Siddharth Vardarajan. How many people can fit into one of those ambassador cars? Well, the answer is... Drum roll, please. Oh, yeah, we cut the drum budget. The answer is not as many as in the past. That's because, like much of the rest of the world, people in India are getting fatter. A new report out today in the journal The Lancet finds that almost a third of the world's people are now overweight or obese. That's more than 2 billion people, including about 300 million in India and China. The study found that the U.S. still has the most overweight and obese residents, but that the highest rates in any region are in the Middle East and North Africa. The report's lead author says there's a strong link between growing obesity and higher incomes, no surprise there, and that the global rise in obesity also tracks higher rates of diabetes and cancers linked to weight. More surprising, perhaps, is how difficult it is to fight this trend. The report says no country has been able to curb obesity rates in more than 30 years. Artists sometimes become unexpected sensations outside their hometowns, heck, maybe even outside their home countries, like being big in Japan. And that's just what happened to one musician from Nashville, only he got big in Sweden. This week, he starts a summer tour there. Ashley Cleek has our story from Music City.
Walking down Broadway, the main drag in Nashville, feels like turning a radio dial. From one dark bar, a woman belts out a song about heartbreak. Next door, hipsters in fedoras and vests play rockabilly to a half-full room, while a man on the street strums his guitar. It feels like everyone is coming to Nashville to get their song heard and make it big.
My name is Douglas Seegers.
It was in downtown Nashville a few months ago that Doug Seegers met the Swedes who would change his life. Doug's 62. He's wiry with deeply tanned skin. He's been playing gigs on this street for decades. He's often lived on the street, too. Everyone downtown knows him. And so when a Swedish television show called Jill's Veranda came to Nashville, a woman who works at the local food pantry suggested Doug play for them. He met the film crew in an alleyway.
They asked me, they said, would you mind if we interviewed you? And I said, well, not at all, as long as you let me play a song for you. Because I'll play for anybody, anywhere, anytime. So I sat there right in the grass, leaning up against the brick building, playing the song and going down to the river.
I'm going down
And as I was singing the song, they were kind of like kneeling down, just they were about maybe 3 feet away, just kneeling down and watching me and listening to the song. And then I started looking in their eyes, and I thought something was strange was happening.
You might guess where this is headed. Little did Doug know that the show, Jill's Veranda, is a big deal. After his segment aired, Doug's song, Going Down to the River, hit number one on Swedish iTunes. All of a sudden, Doug was famous in Sweden.
I've never talked about myself this way in my entire life, believe me, you gotta believe me. But right now I am very, very famous in Stockholm, Sweden. And right now in Nashville, no one knows who I am.
First time I saw that when he performed it on the TV show, and it was a complete knockout.
That's Håkan Olsson. He helped produce Doug's first ever solo album, which he says will likely hit number one.
And I was not the only one feeling that. He's got something very, very special. It's a combination of a good song and some kind of magical performance.
Olsson also booked Doug's upcoming Scandinavian tour. Just how popular is Doug's song? Popular enough that Swedish tourists travel to Nashville to meet him and to hear him play. Sometimes they ask to play with him. Fans have also posted dozens of videos of themselves covering Going Down to the River.
Hello, YouTube.
Hi, everybody. We are Planet Resort, and we're going to do a tribute to Doug Seegers.
I'm going down to river to wash my soul again. I've been running with the devil, but I know that he's not my friend.
It's an honor, you know. That's a nice compliment. That's the best compliment you can get for your music, is when other people start wanting to do it. Because I mean, you know, they like my song. I don't really think it's that special, you know. But evidently, there's some people that like it. So I'm gonna run with it.
Doug will play 60 dates on his tour. Most of the shows are sold out, and he'll be opening at a festival for his heroes, Neil Young and Van Morrison. He even promised one fan to write and play a song at her wedding. As we sit talking on the small porch of a house where Doug rents a room in Nashville, Doug's phone rings repeatedly.
No, this girl is doing a radio interview on me right now. So, I guess, not to be rude, but if you want to call me back a little bit.
Until recently, Doug didn't have a cell phone, or a passport, or fancy clothes. He's never been on a plane before. Everything is new. And that's a lot of pressure.
You know, I got close friends that ask me, you're going to be able to hold up? You know, you're going to be able to handle all this attention and stuff like that? And the honest answer would actually be to say, I don't know. But my own personal attitude is I'm going to run with it. I'm going to give it my best shot, and I'm going to try to knock them dead.
No one I spoke with could explain to me exactly why Swedes have become so obsessed with Doug. He's a good musician with a great life story. But that's true of a lot of people. In the end, it seems, there's just a certain something that appeals to them. And Doug's got it. For The World, I'm Ashley Cleek in Nashville.
I'm gonna jump in that water and baptize them both. Cause everywhere I've been walking, I've been getting in trouble deep.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Some words in Spanish sound just like their counterparts in English. Carro means car, fruta is fruit, straightforward. Then there are words that sound alike but have different meanings. Embarazada may sound like embarrassed, but it actually means pregnant. That's known in linguistics as a false friend. Reporter Daniela Gerson in Los Angeles has another example, a word that can be crucial to understand but is tricky to translate.
Search Medicare or the National Institutes of Health's Spanish language pages for hospice care, and you'll find the word translated to auspicio. May sound close enough, but to Los Angeles resident Manuela Flores, this just seems bizarre.
Hospicio, como donde están los niños huérfanos.
Hospicio means a place for orphans, says Flores, an immigrant from Nicaragua. Spanish speakers from other countries give different definitions. To some, it's a refuge for migrants. To others, a home for elderly people who have no families to support them. But whatever the variation, hospicio means a place for the destitute, and definitely not somewhere you would want your loved ones to end up. Flores says until recently, she'd never come across the concept of hospice care, and she wouldn't even know how to give a name to it in Spanish. In English, hospice means an end-of-life program that can include at-home medical services, as well as psychological and social support. For anyone who is eligible for Medicare or Medicaid, hospice care is free. But Latinos are making use of that service at lower rates.
We have patients being offered, you know, basically, well, would you like to go to the poorhouse to die? And they say, of course, I don't want to do that.
Jason Bowman has devoted himself to studying Latino use of hospice care ever since he took a trip to Ecuador and learned the word was being mistranslated. The Brown University medical student has now completed a national study that has documented the low rate at which Hispanics access the service.
I think it's heartbreaking because, from my point of view, I think the Hispanic culture, possibly more than any other, at least that I've studied, would benefit most from the central themes of hospice, which are, you know, quality of care focused around family and friends and support, you know, incorporating religion and spirituality, avoiding invasive, sterile environments like a hospital.
The Spanish and English words for hospice have the same Latin root, hospice. In Spanish, a few centuries back, the word was adapted to mean a home for the poor who were unable to care for themselves. In English, the concept of hospice as a service to care for the dying took off in the 1940s in Britain and was brought to America in the 1960s. Overall, hospice care is growing, and providers are marketing it to minorities. Listen to this promotional video from an Arizona hospice featuring testimony from a Latino family.
It was difficult for me. I was kind of skeptical with the whole idea of the hospice being a Hispanic, and we take care of our own. But me and my lady were struggling how to take care of mommy. But now that I'm here, the hospice is the best thing. It's the best decision that I ever made.
That's one person who was won over. But there are millions more facing deep cultural barriers. In California, Sylvia Austerlich meets with migrant workers as a cultural liaison for Hospice of Santa Cruz County.
And I say that I work for hospice, and I ask, have you heard about hospice? And always there are many people who never heard that. So it's like, okay, that's great. So let me tell you, we don't use the word in Spanish, hospicio. And I say this, we use the word servicios, the hospice.
She uses the English word to avoid confusion. But then comes the key next step, explaining a new concept.
And I also say that hospice is a program, but it's also a philosophy. And when I say the word philosophy, I look in the eyes to farm workers, and they all nod like, yes, they understand that. It's not just people coming to your house when someone is at the end of life, but it's a different relationship with death. It's not how you want to die. It's how you want to live until the end.
That's something that Manuela Flores, the Nicaraguan immigrant, wishes had been explained to her.
Hospice. Y hablan español. Están dándole explicaciones.
Flores tells me a healthcare worker also used the English word with her, but his explanation was inadequate. She could not grasp the concept of hospice care. When her mother-in-law died less than 48 hours after her family had approved the service, Flores was terrified that they had signed off on her death. Flores believes immigrants like her deserve a better explanation.
Yo no voy a regresar a mi país. Yo hago mi vida ya acá con toda mi familia.
I'm going to end my life here in the United States with all of my family, says Flores, who has lived in Los Angeles for nearly 3 decades. We may not know English, but we are working here, and we need to know about things like hospice care. For The World, I'm Daniela Gerson in Los Angeles.
I hope you heard that interview yesterday with comedian Hari Kondabolu. He was telling me about his name.
Hari Kondabolu. Hari Kondabolu.
Got it. Hari Kondabolu. And so I asked you, how has your name been mangled? Many of you tweeted us with the hashtag, actually my name is.
My name is Beatrice Motamedi.
However, her last name wasn't always Motamedi. Her dad is from Iran and went to Paris for medical school. And the whole time he pronounced his name
Motamedi.
But then the family moved to Canada. Young Beatrice started school and
we began pronouncing our name Motamedi. And that's how I still pronounce it, is Motamedi.
But then the Motamedis moved to the U.S. Beatrice's father started working as a doctor in the ER, and
the American nurses started to say Motamedi.
So her father began using this new pronunciation.
I was like, I can't change. I can't do this. I can't change the way I say my last name. My four brothers, meanwhile, who were younger than me, opted to go my dad's path. And so when we get together for dinner, I'm Beatrice Motamedi, but all my brothers are Motamedi.
Well, that's quite the story. We also heard from more than a few people from, no surprise, the land of consonants, Poland. But this guy?
Przemysław Tadeusz Wawrzyńczak.
That's Przemysław. You get the point. He goes by Chuck. Easy enough. But Chuck actually loves how Americans struggle to spell and say his real name.
Whenever people see my name or hear my name, they're like, wow, where's that from? How do you pronounce it? You know, you get into a whole conversation about it. And by the time I'm done explaining, we're like pretty good, you know each other pretty good.
One more Polish last name now.
My name is Anne Hanakowicz.
It's a Jewish Polish last name, according to Anne, and she's gotten all sorts of mispronunciations.
Somehow Hanakowicz has happened. Hanochowicz, Hanochowicz I've heard before, which is probably more correct than what I say. I don't really know how to say my name properly.
But the worst, says Anne, was in elementary school.
Oh. there's a song. It's John Kanakanaka Turaye. That's the refrain. And so a few kids thought it would be fun to call me Ann Kanakanaka Turaye, which I didn't like very much.
Whatever mispronunciations Ann has endured, she's not bitter nor angry when people get it wrong. If anything, she pays more attention now to how she pronounces other people's names.
It's just humbling because you understand that, you know, to tread lightly, just get their feedback, you know. How do you say your last name?
Me, Marco Werman. My people aren't from Dublin. As you can hear, we're having a little fun with this. If your name gets mangled, tweet us at Global Nation.
I heard the captain say,
John, kanaka, naka, tulai, hey.
Today,
and from the Nan and Bill Harris studios, that's all from us today. Thank you, and special thanks to our engineer, Tina Toby, whose last day is today. We'll miss you. I will miss you, Tina. Your smile through the glass, always there. And we will be with all of you tomorrow back here on The World.
We'll work tomorrow, but not today.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, by the National Endowment for the Arts, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Wachowski, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.